Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Ohioan native Ryan Hughes began his Southern transformation amongst the gullahs of Charleston, South Carolina, before Emeril Lagasse persuaded him to come to New Orleans. Since he arrived 14 years ago, Ryan's plied his trade in some of the city's best kitchens and is now set to use all of his culinary chops at his latest restaurant, Perlu. Then, representatives from the Gulf Seafood Trace program give us the lowdown on a new program that allows you to track your catch from the dock to the pot. And I've got a super fast crawfish etouffee recipe that's ready even before the rice is done. We're serving another delicious hour on this week's Louisiana Eats. Although Ryan Hughes is best known for the French flair he gives to his food, this Johnson & Wales-trained chef is thoroughly Southern at heart. That makes him a perfect fit for the Southern Food and Beverage Museum's new on-site cafe, slated to open later this year. Ryan, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Hey, Poppy. Thanks so much for having me today.
So, first of all, let's talk a little bit about your background. Where do you come from and how'd you end up here?
Oh, boy. Yeah, I'm a Yankee transplant. I was born and raised in Ohio, Dayton, Ohio, land of corn and fields for miles. I worked at a classical French restaurant called La Maisonette in Cincinnati, Ohio, when I was in college, and it kind of blew my mind away. You know, that was the first actual real restaurant that I worked at, trained under Chef Jean Robert, and he just kind of showed me a whole different world, you know, and it kind of touched me where I could, under some strict guidance, you know, be creative at the same time. From there, I left and went to culinary school at Johnson & Wales in Charleston, South Carolina. That was my first real foray into living in the South, deep South, Charleston of all places.
Mm-hmm.
Loved it. Beautiful, beautiful town. You know, I was just totally taken back by it. I'd never been there before.
Wonderful people. Great food.
Great food, man. Well, this was 15 years ago, and that was kind of like before the whole food scene kind of exploded there.
It was right around the time when Hoppin' John was trying to tell people about Stone Ground Grits.
John Martin Taylor, exactly. I'm still friends with him to this day. Yep, he's amazing. I use his grits on my menus. My chef, Jean Robert, told me, he's like, well, if you're in Charleston, Ryan, he's like, you need to look up a friend of mine, Louis Osteen. I was like, Louis who? And he's like, just go by and see him and tell me what you think. So I stopped by his restaurant, and here's this gregarious kind of large man with glasses. I think he had a beer in his hand at 10 o'clock in the morning.
That sounds like Louis.
It's Louis. God bless him. And he's like, who are you? And I'm like, my name is Ryan Hughes, and I would love to be your pastry chef. And he kind of like lowered his glasses down, gave me a look, and he's like, interesting. And I was going to school in the daytime in the morning. And he's like, I might be able to fit you in at night. Little did I know that Louis Osteen, he was kind of like one of the founding fathers of bringing back low country cuisine.
You know? Oh, yeah. And such instrumental part of the Southern Foodways Alliance.
Southern Foodways Alliance. He's been heavily involved in that, kind of like the Paul Prudhomme of the low country in Charleston. So his presence, you know, was well known not only in Charleston, but all over the South. So before I started, he told me, he's like, all right, Ryan, he's like, come back tomorrow morning. I think it was a Saturday and I was not in school. I was all nervous, didn't know what to do, you know, dressed to the nines. I had my starched white chef jacket, my pants, you know, I shined up my little leather clogs, rode my bike on in there, and he gave me another look and he's like, all right, son, first thing you need to do is you need to learn how to walk properly. I was like, excuse me? He's like, you walk like a Yankee. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, I was like, who is this guy? He's like, you walk too fast. You need to walk a lot slower. And so I was kind of taken back by that, too.
I guess so. I've never heard a restaurateur tell anybody on staff to walk slower.
Walk slower. So I was like, oh, boy, what am I into? You know, but it was just completely different from where I was raised, but in a good way. You know, a lot more personable. But what he was getting me to do was just to slow down. He knew I was busy. He knew I was young. He's like, if you're going to understand Southern food, you need to slow down. I don't care if you know all these classical French techniques. What we're going to do first is learn how to make biscuits. So he taught me how to make biscuits. We rolled up our sleeves, went into the pastry shop, and got a big thing of, he used white lily flour. I didn't even know what that was at the time. And he's like, you have to use this flour because this is what my grandmother used. So it was just interesting. I've never had anybody work with me that closely. Just using their own Southern food ways passed down from generations, and that was my exposure to the South.
Well, no wonder you fell in love with it.
I fell in love. Yeah, I really did. Yeah.
And so then how'd you get to New Orleans?
Well, that's another good little story. We were doing an event, a charity event, at Lewis's restaurant, and here comes in this gentleman who was a chef with a whole entourage of sous chefs and whatnot, and he was doing I can remember to this day, crawfish pie. I think his sous chefs forgot to bring the pie dough recipe or something like that. And Lewis warned me about the chef. He's like, don't get in his way. Whatever he needs to get done, just get it done. There was chefs from all over the country in the South coming. So I saw that the sous chefs were panicking, and I was like, okay, just what are you trying to make? I can help you make quick pie dough for the crawfish pie that we had to make, I think. I forget how many pounds of it was to feed like 3,000 people. So it was a lot. Oh, yeah. It was huge. So I kind of helped him out. Here come walking in the chef, and he introduced himself. And he's like, hey, he's like, I heard you helped us out with this. And he's like, I want to introduce myself. My name is Emeril Lagasse.
Mm.
I was like, hey, Emeril, how are you? And that's the first time I met him. And that was when he was first on the Food Network. And he just had, I think at that time, Emeril's. And his show was How to Boil Water. That was his first one.
He had just begun to say BAM?
I think so.
This predated BAM?
This might have been predated BAM. I'm not sure. But we hung out, ended up hanging out the rest of the night and the weekend and just started talking. And he's like, I think you'd really like New Orleans. He's like, I'm looking at opening up Delmonico's.
Mm.
You know, the old Creole standard there on St. Charles that had been there for, I don't know how many years. The two sisters had it for about 80 years or whatnot. And they only wanted to sell it to Emeril.
And so did you end up working for Emeril?
I did. I actually had to fulfill an externship. So I worked at Brennan's. Amazing experience. A great experience moving to New Orleans and being here for the first time. I thought everybody actually lived in the French Quarter. Who lived in New Orleans.
In a perfect world, maybe we all would.
I really didn't know. So I had rented a U-Haul, drove all the way straight down here because I had to be at work, I think, the next week, and parked it on Royal Street, of all places. That's what I thought. I was like, well, if the restaurant's there, I think I should live on Royal Street. It was my birthday weekend. I'll never forget. This was 14 years ago. And I just noticed there was just, you know, and I've heard stories about the French Quarter and whatnot. I just noticed there was a lot of friendly men running around. This was my birthday weekend, September.
Oh, let me guess. It was Southern Decadence.
I had no idea what that was. Not a clue. But there was 20, 30 men in leather chaps wanting to help me move my stuff. But I loved it. I thought it was just fascinating.
How can you not?
Yeah, what a great introduction to New Orleans. Here it is. Everything about it. So I worked breakfast at Brennan's up at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, or sometimes not even going to bed, of course.
Yeah.
First time New Orleanian.
I bet you. Do you still have a deep and abiding love for poaching eggs?
Oh, man. Poppy, Chef Mike had me poach 15 cases of eggs, you know, for Sunday brunch. This was before, you know, the whole 9/11 stuff where they were doing 2,500 people for brunch every Sunday.
Yeah.
It was just amazing.
The egg poaching is really something.
Amazing, but they did it to perfection.
Of course.
And they'd done it for years.
What a great way to really get in the trenches and learn the authentic, historical,
absolutely,
real roots of some of our flavors here.
Right. And it was so fascinating to me. Chef Mike came up to me And he came out to me and he's like, well, we've had three other culinary students before you. And he's like, I think you just might work out. I like you. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, the other ones, they kind of looked at what we were doing and they didn't necessarily agree with it. And I'm like, what do you mean you didn't agree with it? Well, there's just a lot of things that they do there that they've done for so many years that might not be culinarily correct. I don't know how to pronounce, you know, to say it.
Yeah.
Just different ways of doing it. It's fascinating when you take these recipes and dishes and you've done them for 40, 50, 60 years and you've done them hundreds of thousands, if not maybe millions of times, they start to get variegated. And you can't put it down on paper and you can't really describe it, but it's not necessarily the way that they would teach you in culinary school to do it. Doesn't mean it's the right way or the wrong way, but if it's done in a restaurant that's been so successful that many years, guess what? It's the right way.
Exactly. If it's the Brennan's way.
It's the Brennan's
way. It's the Brennan's way.
Absolutely.
We've been listening to Chef Ryan Hughes, whose journey into the South has transformed him from an ambitious sous chef into a skilled and loquacious culinarian. We're coming right back with more Southern Food Talk from Chef Ryan Hughes. How about some purlieu? Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Our conversation with Chef Ryan Hughes continues with the lowdown on his new project at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, Purlieu. So how wonderful you have been here for, it's 14 years now.
14 years, yeah,
and
absolutely.
I know that you have made the trip through all sorts of various cooking establishments. Yep. And I think I became really aware of your food and your big fan when you were at Café Degas, because I, too, have just such an intense love for classical French food. I just
Me too.
Love the sauces and
yeah.
the butter. And, you know, what are you going to do? But now you're actually getting ready to open up a new project. The Southern Food and Beverage Museum
yes.
is going to open up their visionary, enormous new location.
Huge.
Huge on Aretha Castle Haley. And you're going to have a restaurant in there.
Absolutely, yeah.
And what's the name?
It's called Purlieu. My partner, Del Dempsey, and I had been shooting around ideas for names for some time. We were looking at just different things. She wanted to call it Madeira. You know what? I was like, let's just call it something different that people don't maybe know what it is, and it rolls off the tongue well at the same time, so it kind of piques people's interest.
So what is Purlieu?
Purlieu. When I was back in Charleston working with Louis Osteen at the Charleston Place Hotel, there was a whole gathering of women there that would work for room service, and they were Gala.
Yes.
Galanese. I don't know if that's how
Gala.
You
Gala. I think it's just Gala.
I think it's Gala. They would always cook their own family meal for themselves, and I would go up there and just ask them questions. I was just curious about what they did. And I remember every Thursday or Friday, and it's kind of funny because the same kind of way we do things here in New Orleans every day of the week, different days of the week, it's traditional to do different dishes. They would cook a meat and rice dish. Sometimes it would be chicken. Sometimes it would be fish. They would use pork neck bones, I think, in some of it. And they called it purlieu or purlau or purlieu.
I like that way.
That's, I do too. I think it rolls off the tongue well. And I think
so this is a very traditional rice-based dish of the Gullah people
Correct.
Of South Carolina.
Yes.
Well, that's
kind of like a predecessor to jambalaya. Which
well, you know what? I don't know if it's necessarily a predecessor. I think it's a kissing cousin.
Kissing cousin.
Yeah, that's the way I see it. But it's definitely something that people down here are not familiar
They're
with.
They're not familiar. That's what I think makes it interesting.
It is. Yeah. That I think that is a great name. So what's the experience going
to
be like?
Okay, well, the experience is, and I started putting down just pen to paper, and I was like, okay, we've got the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. What do you think about Southern food? Well, what do I think about Southern food? And it's like, okay, you're in New Orleans. I think the New Orleans thing, I don't want to say it's played out because it's not. It might be played out in New Orleans. There's so many people doing really great New Orleans food and Louisiana food, but no one really, I think, is doing really good regional Southern food. It's becoming more in vogue. There's some great newer restaurants that are doing a very, very good job of doing it.
Well, a museum is a learning experience.
Correct.
And so what is it that you are going to try to inform your museum eaters about with your food?
Well, that's a great question. I think by studying and looking at the old regional Southern foodways from old Florida, you know, that's undiscovered. Look at, and I just did a Lowcountry Carolina menu. A lot of people don't know about that. Look, Appalachia. Look at Virginia. You know, a lot of people down here in New Orleans, and for that matter, outside of New Orleans, they're not familiar with those type of old Southern foodways.
Well, so we're very insulated here in so many ways.
Exactly. So to kind of play around with those indigenous Southern foodways, not to make it Disney, it's a small world, you know, kind of thing.
Thank you. Good.
It's a small Southern world where you kind of got like highlights from everything that's going to go on there.
You're not going to mix some things up drastically on a plate then, huh?
I can't promise that.
Okay.
But I think that's what makes this whole project interesting. Nobody else in the country is doing it.
No.
It makes it interesting not only for me, but for my cooks, for the people with the museum, for our customers. As a chef, I never stop learning. I don't really know anything, you know. It gets me studying stuff and researching these old processes and foods and learning with it and doing it. And it makes it exciting for myself.
So how do you plan to introduce these different Southern regional foods to your Purlieu customers?
I think the best way to do it is to introduce a topic to anybody is to have them taste it, to eat it. You know, I think you write a menu together and there's different things, concepts that people might not understand, but I think if they trust you as a chef and as an operation, I think they'll start to go for it. I think locals will go for it and out-of-towners too. I did a shrimp dish where I got these big, beautiful Gulf shrimp. I mean, they were the size of the dinner plate from, you know, with the head on it. We love those.
Yeah, those are the kind that I'm always worried I'm going to see in the water when I'm swimming too. Because that kind of frightens me.
They're sharp
me.
On the front too. You got to watch it. I had this old lady, I looked over after the plates were being cleared, and these two old ladies actually had that, because I served it with the head on it, of course, you know, just for that impact and visualization. But the two old ladies were actually picking up the heads like crawfish, and they were squeezing together the sides and sucking the juice out of the heads. And I'm like, okay, that's a hit.
That's New Orleans for
that's
you.
That's New Orleans. I love it.
That's head sucking good.
So for that dish, I thought it was really cool. It's like everyone knows what succotash is.
Mm-hmm.
I hope so. But the menu that we were doing was Lowcountry cuisine. And in Lowcountry, they use lentils and butter beans or lima beans fresh, and they call it circuit hash.
Circuit hash.
Circuit hash.
Oh, that's so cool. There's going to be.
It sounds cool, too. Yeah.
So I guess there's going to be a lot of Purlieu surprises you've got up your sleeve.
All kind of surprises, you know, and it's a way of, I guess, repackaging things. A lot of the stuff that they use in the Carolinas all the way to Texas, you know, we can find here in Louisiana. The climate is temperate. Everything grows really, really well down here. And a lot of the farmers, especially with the farmers markets and whatnot that are popping up all over town, they're finding a way to kind of cross-pollinate each other where they're sharing ingredients and stuff. And I love that. You know, you can go to the farmers market here and they figured out a way that they're using stuff from Alabama farmers and trading stuff. So I can go to the farmers market, seeds or the actual produce itself. So I can go to the farmers market here any day of the week and get amazing stuff from Alabama to Mississippi to Texas. And as a chef, that's heaven to me. You know, and you can't emphasize that enough. But
well, you've already surprised me with some of these dishes that I've never either heard of or seen on a New Orleans plate. That's for certain. So while you're waiting for the construction to finish, you have discovered a interesting way to sort of test out some of these regional menu concepts, huh?
Correct. Let's test it. Why we wait.
So what you doing?
So my another one of my partners, Buck Williams, he stumbled upon this great old bed and breakfast on Britannia. It's called Creel Gardens Bed and Breakfast. It's at 1415 Britannia Street. But they've got this dining room that seats 50, 55 people downstairs. And Buck's like, Ryan, he's like, you got to come by and check this place out. I think it might work for something. I walked into the place, actually walked in the front door, and I was like, wow. I was like, this is really cool.
So you're doing a little Purlieu pop-up?
I'm doing a pop-up, exactly. Every Wednesday, pop-ups are getting trendy, but what it does is it kind of gets us together working on a concept. I'm going to be doing a different southern regional cuisine.
So you're testing.
We're testing it.
Test.
We're testing it within, you know, for myself and for our customers. We've already sold out each one, which has been fantastic.
Great.
We put a Facebook page together. You can go to Facebook and look us up under Purlieu, P-U-R-L-O-O, and like us. And you can follow our menus on there, see what we're doing, get our updates. I announce the menu a week ahead of time. I'm going to be doing a Floribian or Floridian menu.
That's something I haven't heard before.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, I like that.
Come on now.
So, Ryan, are there any challenges that you are finding with the pop-up business model?
The challenges are figuring out how to market yourself outside of your just word of mouth to your friends. Mm-hmm. We're using Facebook.
And you just tweeting?
I don't tweet.
Well, no. You better get on that.
I know. I've been told, but I just don't want to be consumed by that, you know? I guess I need to do it, yeah. So tweeting's good. I take pictures of me going to the markets, talking to fishermen. I actually went down with Lewis Raines. He's my crab and seafood guy. And talked to him down there where they actually get the oysters from and the crabs. We are working with the American Cocktail Museum. And they're going to be designing us different cocktails for different southern regions to go along with it. Buck Williams, my partner, he works for Vino Wholesale, so he's doing a wine pairing with it. I do six courses. It's $48. You can't beat it.
No, you can't beat that. And I got to tell you what, I just think that this is such a cool way and a great way to really test run before you open the doors on a really significant project like this.
It is, yeah. I get to feel it, get great feedback from the customers.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So, Ryan, will you please come back and keep us posted about Purlieu and other Chef Ryan Hughes doing?
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me.
Chef Ryan Hughes of Purlieu. Classic Louisiana dish, étouffée, speaks volumes about the Cajun people and their French heritage. By the time the Acadians reached the swamplands and prairies of southwest Louisiana, their language had begun to evolve. Because of the hard life, which required every hand available to help scrape a living from the land, Cajun French became more of an oral tradition than an actual written language. The word étouffée clearly illustrates that evolution. In classic French cooking, étouver is a verb, which means to cook a dish gently in a tightly covered pot, what Americans would call to smother or stew. It's easy to understand that the Cajuns, many generations already removed from their French homeland, remembered that great-great-grand-mère cooked something in a way that she referred to as étouver, which the Cajun ear heard as étouffée. Now let's get down to cooking it. Melt a stick of butter in a sauté pan. Add 2 tablespoons of tomato paste and whisk together over a medium heat for a couple of minutes to deepen the flavor of the tomato paste. Add 1 bunch of thinly sliced green onions, a minced garlic clove, 1.5 teaspoons of thyme, and a bay leaf, stirring all together for another couple of minutes. Empty a 1-pound bag of crawfish tails into a bowl and rinse out the bag they were packed in with a 1/2 cup of water. You've got an instant crawfish stock. Now whisk that into the butter and tomato paste, and the sauce will smooth out. Add the crawfish tails and cover the pot, reducing the heat to low. In 5 minutes, your etouffee is ready to season with salt and hot sauce and serve over hot rice. For a copy of this recipe and a treasure trove of others, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org.
Crawfish crawl, crawfish crawl, you're doing the Louisiana crawfish crawl. You keep you shuffling backward all along the wall and call it the Louisiana crawfish crawl.
Baton Rouge-based food writer and photographer Frank McManus is always on the hunt for delicious new flavors as he crisscrosses our state with camera, notepad, and appetite. Frank, what's the news from the road?
Well, hello, Poppy. The news from the road is that it's pretty delicious out there, which is good news. So I've had the opportunity to eat at a place that goes by BB and PF, which means bean burgers and plantain fries. It's a sort of pan-African spot located on Highland Road between downtown and the LSU campus. Used to be an old Chinese restaurant called the Red Flower that's probably pretty well known to anybody who went to LSU. But they've converted it into this pan-African sort of Nigerian, but certainly drawing its culinary inspirations from all of Africa, sort of a place. And their main emphasis, as the name would suggest, is on bean patties or fritters served in a variety of different ways, and then plantains served in a variety of different ways.
Frank, this is really the first time I think there's been an African eating choice in Baton Rouge, huh?
To my knowledge, it is. I still just can't wait for the day that we get an Ethiopian restaurant here. But until then, this will definitely satisfy a curious eater. The bean patties that are made are served for breakfast, lunch, and for dinner. For breakfast with what they call pap, which is sort of similar to kind of polenta or creamy grits. It's just basically a cooked creamy cornmeal. And then a very similar bean patty is used in a sort of burger presentation served with fried plantains on the side that at first glance, you know, really closely resemble French fries, but obviously don't taste anything like them and are just off the charts.
And so how do they spice this food up? When you hear a word like pap, your first reaction is going to be, that sounds kind of bland.
Yeah, in fact, I think it probably is listed as bland in the dictionary, but it's mainly sort of enriched with dairy products to give it that creamy texture. I tasted a little bit of what I thought was some cumin in there, but keep in mind, this is a breakfast dish, so it wasn't really kind of designed to hit you over the head. The lunch, however, is a very evenly seasoned patty that they serve on a bun, which is either sort of a sweetbread bun, comes with the sort of typical fixings of a burger, but it had a lot of other vegetables mixed in. You could definitely taste onions and celery and garlic in there, and then some other sort of familiar flavors like chili powder and that kind of thing. But it was subtle. It was delicate. It's not real over the top. What's nice about it is it's so crisp and well cooked. Both the plantain fries and the bean burger are excellent examples of what you can do when you're frying foods.
One more question. Did you meet the owners?
I met a very nice person who was working the counter, but, you know, in an effort to sort of maintain my undercover persona as the roving reporter, I didn't want to blow cover and start asking too many questions. So.
Okay, well.
But it's definitely staffed by people with very convincing African accents.
Okay, well, it sounds like it's the genuine article, so.
I believe it is.
Well, thank you so much for taking us on that exotic trip, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us sometime soon.
Anytime, Poppy.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter Frank McManus. Ever wonder just where that shrimp you're eating came from? When we come back, Melinda Kelly and Alex Miller explain how the new Seafood Trace program reveals the trip from the dock to your poor boy sandwich. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero was a young Mississippi girl when she went to work as a home economist for NOPSI, New Orleans Public Service Incorporated, the power and light company that operated New Orleans public transportation system. There in a test kitchen on Barone Street, our hero helped develop treasured recipes for the Rider's Digest, a pamphlet found on all the city's buses and streetcars. In those test kitchens, she became friends with Alberta and Octavia.
The two black ladies who were assigned just to the Home Service Department knew a lot about cooking, probably more than any of us did. Their job, they were behind the scenes whenever we were doing a food demonstration, and everything was set up on trays, and they would set up all of the trays, everything that you needed for each dish that was going to be prepared. And as the time came for you to present that and to do basically your sales pitch, they would pass those trays out to you, and then you would pass the dirty ones back to them. One or the other of them was with us all the time. If we did a nighttime demonstration, they were there with us. And then at that time, they would stay, and we would prepare a dinner for the two of us that we would eat in our little back kitchen.
Much to her dismay, our hero encountered a policy of racial discrimination in the workplace.
One point in time, I was sitting at the table upstairs eating dinner with, I don't recall if it was Alberta or Octavia, one of the two, and a gentleman who was, I'm not sure if he was a vice president or whatever, anyway, he was much over us, walked through the kitchen and did not like what he saw. So the next day, we got the word that we were not to sit at the table with them to eat.
Bravely, our heritage hero and her white co-workers came up with a way around this prejudicial policy.
So to circumvent that little ruling, from then on, we just stood up to eat our dinner. It was just beyond our ability to insult those ladies by not sitting down with them.
That's why Billy Carpenter is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Congratulations to you, Billy. We'll always save a special place for you to sit at our Louisiana Eats table. Alex Miller is the staff economist for the Gulf States Marine Fisheries Commission, a quasi-governmental group established by Congress with the purpose of promoting and protecting the Gulf fisheries. Alex is also the program manager for Gulf Seafood Trace. Joining us in our conversation is Melinda Kelly, the project manager for GCR, Inc., the consulting firm responsible for Gulf Seafood Trace's outreach, enrollment, and overall communication strategy and execution. Whew, that's a mouthful. Alex and Melinda, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Well, it's great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Alex, explain why and how the Gulf Seafood Trace program was initiated.
Well, this came from a congressional appropriation, and the intent of Congress was to try to better place Gulf seafood in the market. And the real intent was to move forward with different types of marketing activities, traceability activities, sustainability, and some seafood testing. So within all that, we created this traceability effort to do those things, to better market it and hopefully increase demand and the price for Gulf seafood.
The program that you created has an electronic traceability platform. Can you translate that part into layman's terms? How does that work?
Right. The electronic traceability platform really connects the boat to the plate. And it starts at the boat and at the dock with this electronic trip ticket system that feeds the electronic traceability platform, where different businesses in the marketplace or in the supply chain can put different types of information in there, so the different players or the different participants in the marketplace can access that information. Everybody from the processor to the distributor to ultimately the consumer, the retailer, the restaurant.
So everybody's hands that this is passing through, from the fisherman's hands to the dock to the processor to ultimately the chef, all the fingerprints are very clear in this, right?
Right, absolutely. They can all put in different types of information and access information to do a whole variety of different things better, differentiate their product, communicate the quality, communicate a particular certification. So it's really a tool but that empowers these businesses in the marketplace.
And it helps tell the story of the fishermen, too.
Absolutely.
All of this is done, as I understand it, with a quick reference code, which many of us have probably seen and maybe didn't even know what it is. What does that look like, and how does that work?
Well, a quick reference code, otherwise known as a QR code, is sort of this square set of dots that allow a consumer to scan it with their phone to access a particular website. So in a magazine, it might take you to a particular company. But in our case, it connects you to this electronic traceability platform that we were talking about so that they can see where their seafood came from, how it moved through the marketplace, access and learn about the story of the fisherman or the boat or the community, access recipes, tasting notes. You name it, that seafood business can put it on there. You have a lot more space and opportunity to put information there that you don't traditionally have on a package or on a menu or something. So it's a tool. What we're doing here is putting a tool in the hands of the seafood business to help them better position themselves in the market.
Yeah, and it just depends on their business goals, how they want to use that tool. This tool allows them to market themselves better to consumers. It helps with fraud reduction, like you were saying, mislabeling, and it helps with faster recalls because it's electronic.
How's it going as far as the people coming on board with mm-hmm. this project working with you?
We find that it's significant and encouraging because it's a voluntary program. So if you think about it, these businesses are committing to volunteer their time and effort and put it into a tool that they might not see benefits for right away. You know, this might be a long-term solution for their business. They might eventually gain more clients or hopefully get a better price for their product. But in the short term, they're going to have to put in a lot of work to get there. And so 20% of the industry seems pretty significant to us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's your piece of the puzzle, right, Melinda?
Right.
You do the outreach.
Yep.
So, you know, anybody who's ever worked with people in the seafood industry knows they don't get corralled real well.
No, they don't.
How's that project going for you? Describe what your process is like.
So most of my day is spent trying to engage the seafood community, get them interested, educate them on the program, and really finding which businesses would be right for this program. It's not necessarily for everyone, although we wish that everyone would participate. These early adopters that we've found so far are very innovative. They're a lot of your larger processors, so they're equipped to handle this new technology. And what we would like to eventually get to is their docks, their related businesses. You know, we need to start penetrating the market. But I love the outreach to processors. Right now it's going really well. They're very receptive. There's healthy skepticism, as there is with any free governmental program. But we found that overall they're very receptive.
So it's free. There aren't any costs related to the fishermen and the processors?
Right. Until the end of 2014, the Gulf States Marine Fisheries Commission, through this congressional appropriation from the Department of Commerce, covers the cost of this technology. So they're able to try it out and see if this is something they want to keep going with in the future and see if it's right for their business.
Right.
And I imagine the ultimate goal is to be able to translate this into profitability. Are you starting to see that? What sort of results do you have?
Well, that's hard to quantify. We've had a couple of processors indicate that they've picked up a number of different buyers, retailers. But in terms of an actual percentage of an increase in the price for Gulf Seafood, that would be hard to really pinpoint and say that's just a result of seafood traceability or by doing these types of things. So we plan to do some surveys later on to try to better understand how the program has helped their business. But that is ultimately the goal, to better position their business in the marketplace and hopefully have some increased returns on investments.
The feedback we've gotten so far is that it has helped them get new business. Mostly it's helped them keep the business they have, which unfortunately is a goal right now for most of these guys. Companies like Whole Foods require this exact traceability software, which our program gives to the industry for free. So a lot of them are able to keep their existing clients like Whole Foods by engaging in this traceability program.
Ultimately, I believe that a large factor in this story is that it really is telling the story of the fishers and crabbers and oystermen who actually harvest our Gulf seafood. And personally, I always feel that food tastes better when it comes to the table and you know the people who are bringing it there. And this is such a rare opportunity for the consumer to get to know the fishermen without ever having to make the trip down to the dock. So could you give us a specific fisherman's tale that perhaps they might be able to find with their smartphone by just using the QR?
Yeah, it's hard to pick just one to choose from. Yeah, but if we could elevate one, it would have to be Mike Wazan and Motivated Seafoods out of Houma. The industry lost Mike, and his participation in our program has been unbelievable. His business is not yet to the point where they're putting QR codes on their bags, but that was an effort that was underway, and I think that they'll get there. And what consumers would find if they were to scan his QR codes is that his business is multi-generational. They have embraced technology for generations. Their oysters are safe. They're very unique in their marketing efforts because they gold band their oysters. They're very easy to shuck, and they're sourced locally. So we're hoping that when end consumers know better, they'll buy better. And when they scan those QR codes, if they see that it is local, they'll want to support people like Mike and his family.
Is there anything new coming down the pike in these efforts that we should be looking for?
Well, I didn't talk about it much, but under this funding that we have at the commission from Congress that developed this oil disaster recovery program, we a significant part of that is seafood marketing. And what that funding did was develop the Gulf Seafood Marketing Coalition. And we've recently created a partnership with them with our traceability program that the seafood that they use for their retail and food service promotions, it has to be traceable. So there's some different retail partnerships that are about to be kicked off with a couple of different retailers that you'll be able to, well, they'll be able to have the traceability right there in their hands. So that's something that's new. We have some other opportunities out there with different restaurant associations and those types of things. We haven't done too much on the food service side, but we're looking to move into that area.
And that's really the next phase of the program. This first year, our focus was on establishing engagement with the processors and getting people signed up. Well, now that we have a significant number of the industry signed up, we need to push that information out to the consumers. And that's what we're poised to do in 2013.
Well, this is so much fascinating information. Just in time for our biggest seafood eating time down here in Louisiana. So thank you so much for coming to see us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Melinda Kelly and Alex Miller of the Gulf Seafood Trace Program.
Down by the seaside, see the boats go sailing. Can the people hear? Oh, what little fish is saying?
For generations, Collins family has been an essential part of the Louisiana shrimp drying industry. After Hurricane Katrina washed away their Grand Isle business, today they're back maintaining a tradition that's over a century old. Ricky, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell me, how did shrimp drying become such a big business in southern Louisiana?
Well, shrimp drying has a very long and colorful and interesting history. It may have started back as early as the 1860s. A lot of immigrants were used in the building of the Intercontinental Railroad. And, you know, they liked their style of food they ate back in the home country. A lot of Orientals, Chinese, Asians. And there was a demand for dried shrimp as far back as then. So they were looking for a source of fresh product that they could have. And South Louisiana was just a natural area to begin this. So some of these Chinese headed out to the marsh and settled and began drying shrimp on wooden platforms out in the marsh.
So tell me, where is the shrimp drying plant?
Well, the shrimp drying plant is located on the backside of Grand Isle on Bayou Rigo. It's at the end of Smith Lane, or the beginning of Smith Lane, as we like to call it. And we like to say or think that Grand Isle has some of the best tasting shrimp there are in the world. It has something to do with the salinity of the water and location, proximity to the river and the Gulf of Mexico. And for some reason, they just seem to have a better flavor than shrimp caught maybe in other areas.
Well, I can attest to that. So what happens? You bring in the fresh shrimp, and then what happens?
Well, first thing we do is boil them, similar to what you do maybe to eat them for yourself. We add salt, and then we take them and put them in our drying machines, which we have 28 drying machines.
Describe what a drying machine looks like.
Well, it's very simple. It's not something that's engineered. It's something that's kind of a homemade deal. There's a big heater on the end, an industrial heater, and we lay these shrimp on an aluminum bed, and we force hot air through the shrimp.
So you've got these fresh shrimp that you've turned into dried. What is the shrinkage like?
We usually get about 10%. In other words, if we were to get 210 pounds, which is a barrel of shrimp, we should get about 18 to 20 pounds of dried shrimp. So there's a lot of dehydration and shrinkage involved.
It's amazing how they just go down to like nothing.
A lot of people don't realize how good it is, dried shrimp in a gumbo or maybe a shrimp stew. They kind of rehydrate when you cook them, and it makes a real different kind of dish, and it's real interesting.
A very intense shrimp flavor.
Yes, ma'am.
When I was on Grand Isle recently, every place I went, there was what, as a child, I would have thought of as a gumball machine, but they were filled with dried shrimp.
Yes, ma'am. That's kind of unique to our area. We like that, and they're available a lot of places. And we're trying to market it. You know, we feel like if it's good in Louisiana, it could be good anywhere, you know. So we're always on the lookout for new markets and things like that.
Well, I love them, and I find that the flavor of dried shrimp is so sweet and intense, it's almost like candy. Well, Ricky, I want to thank you so much for coming all the way from Grand Isle to talk with us today.
No problem at all. I enjoyed the drive. It was beautiful weather today, and I enjoyed being here, and I thank you for having me.
Ricky Collins of the Louisiana Dried Shrimp Company. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we'll explore where the water beats against the land as we go down on the Batcher with Professor Oliver Hawk.
The fun part of this story and all the stories in here is not just what happened, but what does it sort of mean? What does it mean to find beautiful art that no one will ever see, that people are busy creating down in this scraggly piece of woods? What does that mean? And what does it mean to have people hunting rabbits in this way? And is there something nice about people being free to be able to do it?
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickey Brennan and Company, Blight's Egan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time.
Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.